From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we continue with our Coastline candidate interviews. And on this edition, we meet North Carolina Representative Ted Davis Jr., a Republican from New Hanover County who has held the seat in House District 19 for 2.5 terms. In 2012, he was appointed to finish out the term of Danny McComas, who stepped away to take the helm of the North Carolina Ports Authority Board of Directors. Ted Davis Jr. went on to win the seat in the next election. He won a second term in 2014, and he will soon embark upon his third as he is unopposed this November. Representative Ted Davis, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here.
In North Carolina's 19th House District, which encompasses the southern half of New Hanover County, 87% of residents are white, 6.5% are black, and 6% are Hispanic. 38% of the voters are registered as Republicans, 32% are registered as Democrats, and about 28% are unaffiliated. Since Representative Davis is unopposed in this race, this hour is entirely his to talk with you, and it's yours to ask questions about the issue. There are two ways you can do that. Either send us an email at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call during this live Thursday show at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are open now. Representative Davis, let's start by having you tell us a little bit about who you are. For those folks who've never met you before or heard you talk, what you do and why you want to do this job for another term.
I was born and raised in Wilmington, one of the few people that you'll find that actually has lived here all their life, except when I was away at school. I graduated from New Hanover High School, and then I went on to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, got a degree in political science. Then I went to Wake Forest Law School, got my law degree. After graduating, I worked first as an assistant district attorney for the state of North Carolina. I did that for about 2.5 years. Then I got an appointment to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of North Carolina, where I worked there for several years. And then I left there and came back home. And I worked with the County Attorney's Office for a short period before opening up my law practice, which was a solo practice. I did that in 1984. Originally did criminal defense work, but then I developed a domestic law practice, and that's what I did until I retired last December. I'm no longer practicing law actively. I'm married to my wife, Jane. We've been married 32 years. I have two children that I'm very proud of, my son, Ted III, who's the father of my grandson, Ted IV, and my daughter, Amy. And hopefully she'll be starting a family soon. Both of them are married. And I'm a member of St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, where I've been an elder and a deacon. Hold my faith very, very dearly. I've been trying to be active in the community. When I was growing up, I just always felt like when the community is good to you, that you ought to try to give back to the community. And I was approached to run for county commissioner in 1996.
And that was right here in New Hanover County.
In New Hanover County. Actually, I was a Democrat. I'd been a lifelong Democrat. And I'd met a lot of people, including Danny McComas, that were Republicans that I really liked and that we really had the same mindset about a lot of things. So they came to me and asked me if I would consider switching parties to do that, which I did, and I ran, got elected, and I ended up serving 16 years on that board, which I learned a lot, obviously, not only about local government, but the connection between the local government and not only the state of North Carolina, but the federal government as well. 15 of those years, I was on the Board of Trustees at the community college, so I really got to learn a lot about education and what it means to provide an education for those beyond just high school. So they can go out and, you know, get a job. And so with that background, I was kind of tooling along. And Danny McComas came to me in 2012 and asked if I would consider, if he didn't run again, would I consider running in his place? Quite frankly, I'd had people ask me to run for state office before. I didn't because my children were young. But they were older then, and it's something I'd always wanted to do. Was to go to Raleigh. And the opportunity gave itself, but I would never, of course, would have run against Danny. We were just too good of friends. Mm-hmm. So,
and he had held that seat himself for many years.
I was a commissioner 16. He was in the House, I believe, 18. Mm-hmm. So when he did that, I gave it very, very serious thought, and I did. I got the appointment, and I had a contested election the first time, and very fortunately, I've not had a contested election the last two times.
And when you go back to that time, you said you were raised as a Democrat, had been a lifelong Democrat, and then switched to the Republican Party to serve on the county commission. What was the basic difference in the ideologies that caused you to say, you know, I think I'm more aligned with the Republican philosophy?
Of course, as you know, when I was growing up, you had to be a Democrat if you want to be involved in politics. You could count the number of Republicans in Wilmington on really on your two hands. And actually, the primaries were the elections, because whoever won the Democrat primary was going to win, you know, the general election. I just found in meeting those other people that they were just more in line with the way I was thinking and the things that were important to me. And I've always been a conservative. I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road guy, kind of a conservative. I'm not far right. I'm not far left. And like I say, I was just comfortable with them and what they believed in and wanted, and that's why I made the switch.
And you said that you learned a lot when you became a county commissioner, probably more than you learned getting your political science degree. When you went to Raleigh for the first time, you've been pretty open in the past about how that was a surprise for you. You went there and discovered that this isn't just about making the best decisions that you think exist for certain kinds of policies. It's much more nuanced and complex. And what surprised you the most when you first got there?
There are a lot of things that would encompass an answer to that question. I think first and foremost was going to Raleigh as a Republican with a Republican-controlled House, with a Republican-controlled Senate, with a Republican governor, and finding out that no one really got along that well with each other. And that was probably my biggest disappointment. There are Republicans in the House that don't get along and have different, you know, thoughts and ideologies, which is fine. The Senate has the same, the House and the Senate, the governor. I guess for me, there was the realization that it wasn't going to be a cakewalk at all. Also, learning how it works. I'm still learning how it works. The learning process really takes a long time. They're just all the maneuvering, how things are done, how things can be done. I have learned that if you want something done, it isn't dead. I don't care if the bill is defeated and it's planted 6 feet in the ground and you put a building over it. There's always a way to revive it. And it's been amazing to me to see the procedures about how you can do that.
Well, let's talk about how you tried to do that with film incentives. That has gone through its own series of...
That was the hardest thing I've ever worked on in my life.
It was very emotional for you.
It was, because I was very, very passionate about that issue, because we have so many wonderful people that lived in Wilmington, talented people that we're very fortunate to have, that worked at the studio. And, of course, their livelihood depended on the movie industry. And it was fascinating to go to Raleigh. And now, of course, anything I say is more towards my experience with the House, because you're more limited in what your experience is in the other chamber. But, I mean, I was just shocked at those who did not believe in incentives no matter what, even though I tried to explain how the film, at that time it was a film credit, now it's a film grant, trying to explain to them how it worked, trying to explain how important it was not only to New Hanover County, but to the whole state.
You actually had to explain that to Representative Rick Catlin, who is from this area at one point, because he started out an opponent of incentives of any kind.
Yes, he and Chris Millis actually introduced a bill that really started putting the nails in the coffin for the movie industry, unfortunately. But it was amazing to do that. Then I had to face those people. Like I said, at that time it was a tax credit, but it wasn't a tax credit. Actually, it was a reimbursement, because what you would do at the end of a production, you would have an audit, and then there were certain expenses that a company could make that were called qualified expenses, and then the state would reimburse 25% of those qualified expenses. And so the problem there was is that those in the House and the Senate who were trying to get rid of tax credits, there's been a move for some time to try to get North Carolina to where we pay no income tax, a consumption tax. And one of the things I told them up there was, I said, well, you know, I'm not a rocket scientist, but if you do that, what are you going to do about real property tax deductions? What are you going to do about mortgage deductions? What are you going to do about charitable contributions deductions?
Because you know, you're saying structurally they're the same thing.
And the reaction was like, well, duh, I never thought about that. Well, it was the same thing with the film. The misconception of it being a credit caused a lot of people to be against it because they didn't want credits.
You have worked, now that it's been reconfigured into a grant fund, you have worked to fill the coffers a little bit more with grant money. Can you tell us about the most recent?
What happened, see, the beauty about the way it was, I'll call it a credit once again, not, was the fact the state didn't have to have the money up front.
Right.
What you did is you went along, and then at the end, you got the money into the coffers as you were going along, and then you paid it out at the end. With a grant, you have to have the money up front. What the Senate was only agreeable in doing after, as a matter of fact, I got the film credit extension for a year to be passed in the House. Like I said, one of the hardest things I've ever worked on in my life, and the Senate wouldn't even look at it, wouldn't even address it. So what was left was a grant with $10,000. Well, that's a joke. I mean, it's an insult. It really is. So I worked very hard, and after the last session, with the help of the Speaker, Tim Moore, and the leadership, I was able to get the House to agree to $30 million, and the Senate came on board with that. So that's what we have now, which is still not very much.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews on 91.3 FM. Today we're talking with Representative Ted Davis, a Republican from New Hanover County. And of course, we're taking your questions. You can either email them to coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are open. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're joined today by North Carolina Representative Ted Davis Jr., a Republican from New Hanover County who is finishing out his second term as the representative for State House District 19. He will soon begin a third term. He is unopposed in this year's election, and we're taking your questions. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Representative Davis, a political scientist and pollster from Elon University, recently said the unpopularity of HB 2 may actually have a reverse coattail effect on even the presidential race, generating a bit of added support for Mrs. Clinton by mobilizing progressive voters to turn out. We've recently watched the state of North Carolina hemorrhage performance cancellations, Itzhak Rabin, Bruce Springsteen, Maroon 5, athletic associations and events being pulled out of the state, conferences being canceled. Just yesterday, the state of California joined five other states that banned travel to North Carolina. You voted for HB 2. What was your thinking behind that? Do you think that there are unintended consequences? And is this something that you'll be taking up again in the next session? Is a repeal of HB 2 on the table?
I'll try to answer those in order as best I can. When Charlotte did what they did, I took the position, as did others, that they did not have the authority to do what they did. Quite briefly, the reason why is in that ordinance, let's say, for instance, you have a business here in Wilmington and you want to bid on a contract in Charlotte. You would have to sign a statement saying that if you did get that contract, then you would have to abide by the Charlotte ordinance here in Wilmington, North Carolina, with the company that you had. They have no authority to do that. That makes that local bill have the impact of a statewide bill. That's why I did not feel like Charlotte had acted properly. I know that when it was no secret, the Charlotte City Council had been approached and told that if they did this before the House went into session, that the House would meet as well as the Senate, and look at the possibility of overriding it, depending on what it, you know, the final ordinance, what the language was. Well, they went ahead and did it. That special session was called. There was a public hearing. There's been a lot of misconception about the speed that it went through, and it did go through quickly, but I've had stuff, quite frankly, to go through a committee in the morning and be heard on the House floor that afternoon. I mean, things go through slowly sometimes. Things go through very fast sometimes. But I was at the public hearing that they had. I made a point to go because I wanted to hear from those people who wanted to speak not only in favor of HB2, but also against HB2. And I listened. And but yes, I did vote for it. And I can tell you that I was chosen as a small group of members of the House to try to work on a resolution. And our group, there was also a group in the Senate that was trying to work on a resolution, and we were making progress. And as a matter of fact, we were keeping in touch with the NBA to make sure they would be on board with what we were working on. And very unfortunately, at the end, it just all fell apart. And it could not happen. And it did not happen. And unfortunately, one thing we did do when that fell apart was there was a minor point about a particular type of a employment discrimination lawsuit that might have been in jeopardy of someone being able to bring the way that HB2 was written. We cleaned that up so that that would not be any restriction whatsoever in any situation where somebody who felt they were discriminated against could sue in state court.
Well, that is one of the major beefs about HB2 when it comes to opponents, and the reason that so many people have been abandoning North Carolina, because they say it strips away the ability for people in the LGBT community to have certain protections.
There, that's different than being able to bring a lawsuit, what you're referring to. And there is a lot of misconception. There was a lot of misconception when it started. I think there's a lot of misconception now because people have not truly read it and looked at it. But what you're the bathroom thing, and I'm very careful and very limited what I say because there's a pending lawsuit, as you know, about that. And I'm not going to put myself in a position where I get involved in that lawsuit as a witness or otherwise. I wish that was not there. As you know, the latest attempt to try to resolve the situation was the legislature. I know the Republicans met in the House and the Senate, and there was enough support between the two chambers that if Charlotte, with no strings attached, would repeal their ordinance, then we, as the General Assembly, would call a special session and go back and repeal HB2. And then hopefully, I wanted a committee to be appointed so that we could have input from different people that would be involved, stakeholders, so that we could carry the discussions further and maybe try to work something out. But as you know, the line's been drawn in the sand. Charlotte will not.
Charlotte refused to repeal that ordinance. And then Governor Pat McCrory said, well, then our hands are tied. And the Star News wrote an editorial about that and, you know, said the irony is Republicans are trumpeting the tax cuts and deregulation that have supposedly jump-started the North Carolina economy, ignoring these untold lost millions from the fallout from HB2. And McCrory has just said, well, we'll let the court sort it out, which could take who knows how long. Is that really an answer? Well, and are you comfortable with North Carolina being viewed by many other parts of the country as a place that discriminates against groups of people?
Remember, the governor cannot repeal HB2. The governor has the authority to call a special session for the legislature to repeal HB2. And, of course, the governor was not going to call a special session to do something unless he was comfortable that it could be done. That's why the two chambers were being contacted and the discussions were being had to see if we had that majority vote so the governor could call. As actually, the legislature can call a special session without the governor under certain circumstances, but there's no reason to do that if you don't have the votes to do it. No one, including myself, had any idea. You talk about unintended consequences of the outfall that came from HB2. I mean, if I could have had a crystal ball and seen that, then I think a lot of people might have taken a different view of what was done. Do I like people saying North Carolina discriminates? Of course not. I just wish that things had not rolled so quickly with people just saying, okay, we're just not going to come here because of this or that. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy in that, Rachel, for mentioning PayPal. If you recall, PayPal is one of the first companies. Well, PayPal supports businesses in China and in other countries where they torture, imprison, and kill homosexuals. But it's okay. But it's not okay for North Carolina. I mean, but it's okay for PayPal to do this elsewhere. You look at a lot of these other businesses, the countries that they do business in that do these things to homosexuals.
But this is the United States, though.
I understand that, but the hypocrisy to me is these companies saying, well, I'm not going to come to North Carolina because we may have HB2, but I'm going to continue to do businesses with countries where they kill, imprison, and torture homosexuals or transgenders or whatever. And I don't think that's right. I think that's very hypocritical. About it. But still, and one thing, if I may, it's the spin game. That's another thing I have learned more since I've been in state government as opposed to local government, is the spin. You being in the radio business know what I'm talking about. Right now, of course, you've got the spin from the governor and the Republican Party at this point saying, okay, and we have gotten rid of a $2.4 billion debt that we were handed when we took over that we owe the federal government for unemployment. Medicaid, my first term there, we had to get $500 million to shore up the shortfall. We are now over. I mean, we are making money, not making money off of it, but we're not losing money. We actually have a surplus. We had a $300 million surplus in our budget. That's all fantastic and shows what has been done since the Republicans have been in up to that point. But what I'm trying to say is that, to me, does not accurately show what has been done as a result of HB2, just like people say, well, this business didn't come or that business didn't come or Bruce Springsteen canceled his concert, whatever. We've got to wait and see at the end of the year, you know, the end of the period of time, okay, this is what we know we lost. This is what we know happened with the economy that we have now, and compare the two and see, you know, how much did we really lose? If we still gain, then obviously things are not as bad as what people say. I'm just simply saying, obviously, there has been economic damage done
there
by
has.
The fact
that and some we can document through cancellations and some we can never know about it, as with the
correct.
Film incentive. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some things we watched some productions leave the state when the film incentive changed. Mm-hmm. And that's documentable when you're talking about the productions that never even considered North Carolina because we have mm-hmm. a grant fund now. We'll never be able to really quantify that. And I think HB2 is a similar scenario.
I agree that there are things about it that we will never know because they don't come to light. The thing that's amazing to me, Rachel, is every day, I thought when I got out of session about hundreds of emails a day would stop. I mean, literally, I don't get that many, but I get a ton of them. And I'm amazed at I have repeal HB2. It's got to go. It's an embarrassment. It's horrible. You know, yada, yada, yada. And then I have countless emails. Don't bend. Stand your ground. This is something we need. This is something we want. It's amazing how divided this state is. It is not in any way, shape, or form, in my opinion, a majority of those are opposed to it, nor is it a majority of those that support it. I mean, it has really torn the state apart.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today we're talking with Representative Ted Davis Jr. He's the Republican incumbent in North Carolina House District 19, and he'll be heading into his third term as he is unopposed this November. We're taking your questions for Representative Davis on this Thursday. The phone lines are open at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. Representative Davis, mm-hmm. you mentioned how polarized this state has become, and this is actually one of the reasons, according to political scientists, that North Carolina is such an important battleground state in the presidential election. As we watch this polarization, how do you, as a state representative, expect to bridge that growing gap? What can you do about that?
Listen. One thing I've always tried to do, I tried to do that when I was a commissioner, and I've tried to do it since I've been in Raleigh, and that is listen. I mean, there have been certain issues where I've gone over and talked to my Democratic colleagues about something and tried to get their support and tried to get them to understand why I was doing what I was doing. In other words, try to work across the aisle. I may be a Republican, but I am not an individual that says, I am a Republican. I will only talk to Republican people. I will not listen to anybody's views other than Republicans. I don't do that. I never have.
Tell us about a time. You do meet with constituents a mm-hmm. lot. You do listen a lot.
I try to.
And tell me about an issue that on which you met with a constituent and you walked into that meeting holding a certain point of view and you left the meeting thinking, I learned something today, or maybe I even changed my view. Can you give us an example?
The one thing that sticks out in my mind the most was after my first session, I wanted to learn more about the educational needs in the state because I was hearing so much on one side, well, North Carolina's doing all of this. Then I've been hearing, well, North Carolina's not doing this. And I really didn't know who to believe or what to believe. So in my district, I visited three of the elementary schools. I've contacted each one beforehand and asked, not only could I wanted to read to the class, I wanted to meet the students, wanted to learn about the school, but I also wanted some one-on-one time with teachers and the administration, the principals. And I did that. And I learned more from that because I heard about teacher assistants. Well, I saw what teacher assistants do. I saw what happens to teachers that didn't have teacher assistants when they're trying to control all the, you know, the students that they had. I listened to them about teacher pay, about teacher benefits. I mean, it really helped me so that when I went back to the next long session where we were considering the budget, that it was very high on my priority list that we do as much as we could for our teachers, meaning not only in the pay that they receive, but also the teacher assistance and other things that have to do with education as far as their funding. That will always stick out with me.
We have a tweet. We have a number of emails people have taken issue with your support of HB2.
Okay. And I respect that.
Someone has tweeted, Davis is hiding behind procedure. Does he believe transgender people are a threat? We've talked about the economic fallout from this, mm-hmm. and you've referred to, is it Dillon's role?
Dillon's role is where a municipality or a town or a county can only have the authority that the legislature has given to it.
But when it comes to the actual group of people that we call this the bathroom bill popularly, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is a direct reference to the notion that it says people must go into when they're in a public building into the bathroom that corresponds mm-hmm. with the gender on their birth certificate. And so Andrew is asking, do you believe transgender people are a threat?
I'm sure Andrew wants to know why I voted for HB2. The reason I voted for HB2 is because that was an issue that we discussed in our Republican caucus. Our Republican caucus agreed to take a stand, and the stand was to support HB2 and to pass it, and that's what I did.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today we're talking with Representative Ted Davis Jr. He's the Republican incumbent in North Carolina House District 19, which represents the southern half of New Hanover County, and he will be heading into his third term. We're taking your questions for Representative Davis on this Thursday. The phone lines are open, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Let's talk about Medicaid expansion. There was a recent study done, and this was published in the journal Health Affairs, which analyzes the impact of the decision not to expand Medicaid on rural hospitals' financial stability. And this particular study looked at all of the states that and compared them, those that chose not to expand versus those that chose to expand Medicaid. We know that approximately 500,000 people in North Carolina don't have health coverage because of that decision. And this study said across the board, hospitals earned more if they were in a state where people had more health coverage. And they also saw declines in the level of uncompensated care that they gave. In other words, rural hospitals particularly were impacted by this and were much more financially stable if they were in a state that had expanded Medicaid. How do you feel about Medicaid expansion at this point? Is this likely to come up, and would you reconsider that stance?
I'm always willing to listen about anything. I'm always willing to reconsider anything I may have previously voted on if there's justification to do it. As I alluded to earlier, one of the reasons that I know that I did not support the expansion originally was, as I said, my first term up there, we had to come up with $500 million to make up a shortfall. I mean, that's a humongous amount of money that could have been spent for other things. So my point being, why would I want to support something to expand a system that was losing and costing the taxpayers so much money? Also, as you know, the federal government offers to help you, but as you know, the federal government never gives you anything without strings attached. Plus, that support that the federal government may have given was not a permanent support. It would have been weaned eventually.
It tapered off over time, but you were guaranteed, I forget what the percentage was, but it was a pretty high percentage, and the state would have only been responsible for a fraction.
Once again, in a perfect world, but we were already seeing a deficit with the system the way it was working, and it seemed to me that it would continue into the future.
You didn't trust the federal government.
I wanted to try to fit. I'm a meat and potato guy. I've always been like that in my law practice, in government. I look at a problem, I try to see how to fix it, and then I fix it or try to fix it. And that's why I felt like we had to get our Medicaid system under control, working properly before we went and did something else.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We have Representative Ted Davis Jr. with us today. We'll be back after 90 seconds. This is Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Representative Ted Davis is with us today. He's seeking a third term in North Carolina's House as the representative for District 19. He's actually not seeking that term. He will have it as he is unopposed this November. District 19 is comprised of the southern half of New Hanover County, and this is your last segment to ask Representative Davis a question on this Thursday. The number to call is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Sue asks us to please discuss the provision that counties cannot raise minimum wage. Once again, we're back to HB 2. That is part of this state law. Counties and municipalities can no longer establish their own minimum wages.
The discussion that was had on that aspect of HB 2, it was really pretty straightforward, and that is, what would it do, for instance, if you had a state where Charlotte could offer one thing as an hourly rate, Raleigh something else, Greensboro something else, Wilmington something else, and have that all throughout the state? It just seemed that we should keep a consistent rate throughout the state, not give somebody maybe a leg over somebody else because they might pay more an hour than somebody else. That was not a huge part of what I recall being a discussion of HB 2. It was really just basically what I've said, and keeping it at a consistent rate, and not allowing each one to start getting into a bidding war, if you will, against another city by, well, I'll raise my rate to this, and then they say, well, if they're going to do that, then I'm going to raise mine to that. It just seemed to be counterproductive.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews with Representative Ted Davis Jr. We have David from Jacksonville. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. the question I have concerns the fact that it seems the Republicans in office at some point made a decision that transgender people seem to be at risk for sexually abusing children and others in restrooms. And that seems to be going in the face of actual fact and actual research, which shows that most people are sexually abused by people they know, by relatives, and not the case at all that it's strangers that they meet in the restroom.
Okay, David, thanks for your call. Let's let Representative Davis answer this.
Once again, I don't recall in my discussions when considering HB2 things that they're being posed in the question. I mean, to me, it was just very simply, do you want people to use a men's bathroom that are men? Do you want women to use a women's bathroom that are women as defined by what they were born at birth? And that was pretty much it.
We have Jason from Carolina Beach. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about the voter restrictions and the court's recent strike them down, and Mr. Davis's thoughts about them. And
okay, sorry, Jason. It sounds like you were in and out there on a cell phone. Representative Davis, Jason was asking about the voter ID law that was struck down by a federal appeals court as targeting African Americans with, I think they used the language, almost surgical precision and imposing cures for problems that do not exist. What are your thoughts on that now?
I'm on the elections committee. I was. And we discussed this. I remember discussions being had as that bill was going through the process. And as I recall discussions and what I considered was is looking at these different provisions to be designed to prevent what I will call on a broad term is voter fraud. We were trying to make it so that if people like the photo identification. I think one of the biggest ironies I recall hearing is that the legislature previously passed a voter ID law and Governor Beverly Perdue vetoed it. And yet when you went to Governor Perdue's inauguration party, you had to have a photo ID to get in. And it's just, to me, I don't understand why this is such an issue with the voting. You have to have an ID when you cash a check. You have to have a photo ID. I could just go on and on and on and on and on. And quite frankly, I was shocked when you would go to vote and they wouldn't even question who you were.
And I think that the surgical precision also included the cutting the early voting hours and ending Sunday voting, you know, targeting practices that African Americans typically use during the election season.
And if I may, the number of days of early voting was cut. The hours were not. What they did is they made the days that they had the voting longer. So the amount of hours, as I recall, wasn't cut, but you are correct, the number of days were. I certainly would never vote on something when I knew that I was doing it to try to prohibit. I don't care who it is, what color, gender, whatever. And that was not my purpose for doing that, nor, in all honesty, was that a discussion that I took part in with anybody when we were discussing that bill.
Do you think energy exploration off the coast of North Carolina is something that should be explored? I think for the near term, the Mid-Atlantic is off the table. That was removed from the federal government's plan for offshore drilling for oil and gas. But I think that plan is 2017 to 2022. Beyond that, is this something that North Carolina should be encouraging, or as a coastal stakeholder, do you say no?
That's an interesting question because I've heard and met with environmentalists who are opposed to it. The seismic blasting, other issues dealing with it could be harmful to our environment, and I would never want to do anything that would intentionally harm the environment. On the other hand, I've gone and listened to the oil companies to talk about how they do these procedures, how they're not as devastating as people make them out to be, the economic benefits that would come from it. And I think you can throw in the mix not only that, but the wind turbines off the coast. You know, there are a lot of my fellow representatives who are from counties, coastal counties, that don't want to see Lynn, you know, look out into the ocean and see a windmill.
There's some concern that that's going to have an impact on tourism.
Exactly. But then they say, well, but we'll make it far enough away that you won't see it. But then I've been very interested in trying to get data on, well, then what's the cost going to be? Is that going to increase the cost when you have to get it from point A to point B? And if it's going to end up costing more, then who's going to suffer the consequences? Well, that's the consumer. I certainly would not want to do anything off of North Carolina's coast that will result in another New Orleans situation. It's a tough one. But I think for me personally, at this point, it is not something that I'm out there charging, you know, out in front of that we should do.
So you're not opposed to it. You're sort of, you think the jury is still out for you.
If I felt comfortable in a perfect world, which is not, but if I felt comfortable that we could do something that would be of economic benefit, not only to North Carolina, but the nation, but mainly North Carolina, and to feed back a minute, there was no guarantee about what North Carolina was going to get out of this.
That's exactly right. There was talk of revenue sharing, but that certainly wasn't a done deal.
Well, I'd have to see it because, oil contracts not worth the papers written on. So I would definitely want to know what North Carolina was going to do. And then look at it as, okay, if this is what we're going to do, is this the right thing to do economically, but also is it the right thing to do environmentally? And I just have to weigh the whole thing.
What is your position on hydraulic fracturing in North Carolina?
The immediate thing, that's another thing I've listened to. I have listened to people who, environmentalists, who are totally against fracking. I've talked with people who are in the business of doing that. The thing that bothered me the most was when you had areas where fracking was going to take place. As you know, it's difficult to do it in the mountains because of the rocks in the subsurface. Piedmont's sort of that same way. So it was a move that they were going to bring that material and put it in eastern North Carolina. Well, I took the position there.
You're talking about the wastewater from fracking. They were going to truck out here to the coast.
And I said, well, if all of this is not as harmful as you say it is, then why are you bringing it to eastern North Carolina to put it in the ground? And I would not support that. So I'm still at the point of I'm willing to listen, but unless it's economically viable for the state and unless it's something that I can be sure that will not be negative to us environmentally, I would not want to support it.
Do you think climate change is real?
Well, definitely. I think that there's things that happen with the climate. That's another fascinating subject that I've read on is that's the data that supports the fact that the sea level's rising. Is it caused by natural sources? Is it caused by man? That's a very interesting an argument. But that also gets into if we're going to have the ocean rising, then, of course, we have to look at, well, what are we going to do about our coastal areas and the homes there, homes that are already there, plus structures that might be built in the future, and how can we help to make it so that those structures now or in the future are not destroyed?
Do you think the legislature in the past has put blinders on where sea level rise is concerned?
I don't know if I can answer that because, once again, I was not there previously. I've really not heard that much discussion about it since I've been in Raleigh.
Because there was a moratorium put on accepting a certain level of sea level rise or accepting recommendations from the science panel. I'm not sure if I have that language exactly right. But
still, one thing I've learned about the legislature is it's good to talk to your other legislators about things, even though it might not be actually under consideration at that point. It might be something down the road, and if you're interested in that, it's always nice to find out who you might have along up there that could be your colleague.
We have Sarah from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment about voter ID and HB2.
Sure.
I'm a trans woman, and I've been here since 96. I had my surgery in 98. And I have a driver's license that said female, and that's plenty of identification. But when HB 2 was passed, suddenly I had to go to get my birth certificate so that I could use the bathroom, and I never show anybody my birth certificate. My question is, it seems like an undue burden. It may not seem like a big deal to ask somebody to have a driver's license to vote or to have a birth certificate that says female on it, but for some people, it's an undue burden that people like Representative Davis apparently doesn't see.
Okay, let's let Representative Davis answer this. Thank
sure,
you, Sarah.
Be glad to. Thank you for the question. Also, there are other ways that a person can identify themselves if they go to vote other than having a voter ID. So that is not, you know, the only particular item that you have to have. So surely that person could get another form of identification if getting the photo ID is a problem.
When you look at recent events like the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the ensuing protests over that, do you think there is a racial divide in the state that state legislators need to take stock of? Is there anything to do there? Do we need to look at our policing methods? Do we need to look at our relationship with between police and law enforcement and communities? What's your responsibility there?
That is an excellent question, because right now people are mad. I'm mad. I'm upset. There are things that are going on that I'm not very happy with. People, it's amazing with the political scene that we have now, and it's going to be really interesting to me in this last month to see how people would react to anything that occurs. But I mean, I was raised to respect authority. I think one of our biggest problems we have now is we don't have the respect for authority. I think, and I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but I think there are a lot of things that happen where people play the race card, where the race card really might not be involved. And I think that is unfortunate, because remember the little boy that would yell there was a leak in the dam and there wasn't. Or maybe it was the wolf. That was it. The wolf.
The little boy who cried wolf.
And it wasn't. And then finally, when something did happen, nobody paid attention, because he had done so many times that there really wasn't something. I'm not making light of events, but what I'm trying to say is that when things happen, and once again the race card or anything else like that is played where it really did not take part in, it helps to damage those causes where it might have been.
Well, Representative Davis, I think we saw the wolf in the cell phone video, and that's the issue. I think that a lot of white people have come through the years saying, well, if you just did things according to protocol, then it would all work out for you and you wouldn't get shot. And what we're finding out now with social media and cell phone video is that, there is evidence that there is a racial divide in terms of how African Americans and white people are treated by law enforcement. There's an issue there.
Yeah, and I'm not making light of that. It's a very difficult question, because there are a lot of different components that can go into that. There is definite distrust with the African American community with law enforcement. I mean, I said earlier, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. I don't know what we need to do to get there. I've always felt like that dialogue is good. But, for instance, there have been shootings, if you look nationwide, where it has been documented that an officer definitely used excessive force or did not have the justification to fire their weapon, which resulted in the death of someone, and they're being dealt with.
Right. In Tulsa, for instance, I think that officer is now.
And that doesn't help, because, once again, see, that's what I'm trying to say. You can feed off of so many things that it can make people here feel uneasy about being around police when they know, well, now, wait a minute, somebody somewhere just got shot. How do I know I might not get that way? And it's just so unfortunate.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. And I think that was our cue to get out of the show. But we're having some technical problems. Representative Davis, final word. What would you say to your constituents as you embark upon this third term?
Just that it's been really has been an honor and privilege to represent the people in my district. And time and time again, people say, well, why do you do it? And I do it because I try to help others. And anytime I can help the people in New Hanover County, it makes me feel good.
That's this edition of Coastline Candidate Interviews. Representative Ted Davis, it's been a pleasure having you today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Remember, one-stop voting begins October 20th. October 14th is the deadline to register. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.